The phone lines are down, the internet has been blocked, and cable TV is also blocked in parts of Kashmir.
India strips Kashmir of its autonomy under cover of near total information blackout. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It turns out that the move is in keeping with a wholesale rewriting of what modern India stands for, one that could have reverberations for generations to come.
The Indian youth will probably not know the history of India it should if things continue at the same pace.
Also, we speak to a historian who examines the role of the frontier in American expansionism.
There's not one president that doesn't use the frontier thesis to justify American power in the world.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
This week, we saw a new, unwritten chapter in India's history being created.
Earlier this month, in the world's largest democracy, a dark and ominous turn. In the disputed state of Kashmir, half administered by Hindu-majority India and half by its Muslim-majority rival Pakistan, India has revoked autonomy for the Jammu and Kashmir region in its control, despite the 67% Muslim majority there. With the stroke of a pen, that majority's political power and constitutionally guaranteed rights have been obliterated.
Article 370, the section of the Constitution that gives significant autonomy to Kashmir, is at the heart of why the region joined India in 1947. It allows the regional government to make its own laws, except in finance, defense, foreign affairs, and communications.
Kashmiri Muslims complain bitterly about their rights and identity being stolen from them.
It's moved at lightning speed without any consultation.
The de facto annexation of the autonomous region into the whole of India is the formalization of long-standing claims on the Himalayan territory. Claims that have been prosecuted with wars, political rhetoric, and widespread human rights abuses against Muslim citizens. And thus, the legislative fiat of the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP was more shock than surprise.
It's been a part of their platform for decades, so it's not a surprise that they were interested in trying to remove this Article 370 and make Jammu and Kashmir a formal part of India without special autonomy.
What has changed over those decades has been the consolidation of political power into the hands of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his BJP and the popular acceptance of the action in the name of both national destiny and national security. Modi claimed that absorbing Jammu Kashmir will create greater regional stability.
The reason that he gave for removing Article 370, which had given Kashmir its special status and greater autonomy, was simple. He said it hadn't worked at all. He said all it had brought was nepotism, separatism, and terrorism.
Thus, under the pretext of hampering terrorist reprisals, the assault on Kashmiri democracy was carried out in an information vacuum. The government cut communications in Kashmir and prevented the vast majority of regional newspapers from publishing. The info blockade reportedly included even human quarantine.
They're not being allowed to come out of their houses, and they don't have any access to any sort of news or information. The phone lines are down, the internet has been blocked, and cable TV is also blocked in parts of Kashmir.
Where protests took place, the government denied their existence, even when the BBC showed video of the police opening fire and using tear gas to disperse a crowd. Modi's administration claimed no such demonstration or police action ever took place. Not that outside of Kashmir, there was much evidence of anger.
Celebrations breaking out in different parts of the country. This is a historic moment. This is the day when Kashmir stands finally integrated with India.
There symbolizes the whole debate and the whole problem that exists. On the one hand, the public here in India strongly behind their prime minister. On the other hand, the Muslims who live in the valley at the moment feeling disconnected, both physically, because they have no way to communicate with the rest of India, and also with their government in Delhi.
How in a democracy can undemocracy be so popular? It's a question Americans lately are asking ourselves, but if we're seeking lessons from the subcontinent, in India, the answer is clear. To engineer a quiet nationalist revolution, to employ the levers of democracy to subvert democracy, requires most of all control of the narrative. And not just by news blackout or legislative shenanigans or even hateful propaganda. As tyrants of the past well understood, to hold power, it is necessary to own history itself. As Indian historian Romila Thapur recently wrote in the New York Times, quote, extreme nationalists require their own particular version of the past to legitimize their actions in the present. This week, on the anniversary of India's independence, producer Asa Chaturvedi examines the ways in which India's far-right political movement, now with a grip on power, is redefining national identity by rewriting the past.
One place to find the identity of a nation is its founding documents and the ideals of those who fought for independence. In India, it was the people on the forefront of the movement to fight against 200 years of British rule.
To the people of India, whose representatives we are, we make appeal to join us with faith and confidence in this great adventure.
That's India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, speaking in 1947 to the Constituent Assembly of India in the country's parliament on the eve of independence. He outlined an egalitarian vision for the country.
This is no time for petty and destructive criticism, no time for ill will or blaming others. We have to build the noble mansion of free India where all her children may dwell.
The Indians' founding principle was a unity in diversity where no matter who you were, you spoke your language, you practiced your faith.
Shoaib Daniyal is a writer for Scroll, an independent English language news site based in India. He covers politics and culture.
Wherever in India you form, no matter the way you looked, you could still buy into the civic nationalism of India, and you could still be Indian in that way.
Today, India is the world's largest democracy, with 1.3 billion people. In 1947, it was the job of Nehru and the Assembly to bring together the diverse interests of the world's youngest democracy. For example, the Constitution itself recognizes 22 languages.
These values are enshrined in India's Constitution, which is drawn up by a Constituent Assembly consisting mainly of people who had fought for freedom against the British. This is happening against incredible bloodshed between Hindus and Muslims when partition happens.
As India celebrated independence, the country was divided into two nation-states. An estimated 15 million people were uprooted as Hindus and Sikhs moved to India and Muslims moved to Pakistan. Despite sectarian violence that has continued over many decades, the ideals of a multicultural, diverse India were still the country's North Star.
And unity and diversity was really pushed out. You know, I remember this right till the 90s when I was a kid, where, you know, you would have these government ads. Basically showed a Muslim and a Hindu and a Sikh and a Christian sort of hanging out and you're doing their thing. There was this message sent out that India sort of belonged to everyone who lived in India.
How is the story of India changing now and who's behind it?
The main actor, I think, behind it is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which just translates to Indian People's Party.
Shortened to the BJP, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party.
They have a very specific and very distinct idea of India from what India was founded on. They believe India is a Hindu nation. In this scenario, if you're a Muslim, if you're a Christian, you sort of get excluded. So this was a doctrine championed by a person who lived in colonial India called Vinayak Savarkar.
Savarkar, a far-right independence activist and writer, popularized the ideology of Hindu nationalism, called Hindutva, in 1923 in an influential text. He wrote that Hindutva is, quote, not a word, but a history.
He basically says that anyone who considers India his holy land is a true Indian. Anyone who has holy places outside of India, for example, Catholics have the Vatican in Europe and Muslims have Mecca in Saudi Arabia, they are not really truly Indian.
The BJP draws inspiration from Savarkar's work and traces its roots back to a pro-Hindu group founded in 1925, the most influential of which is
the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which translates to the National Volunteers Organization.
The RSS. They aren't a political party. They don't stand in elections.
Almost every important person in the BJP was once a member.
This includes Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The tentacles of the RSS spread far and wide.
The RSS has worked at the grassroots for decades. Nobody knew in the 1960s that the BJP would one day come to power.
The rise of the BJP can be traced back to the 1980s, when Hindu nationalists led a violent movement to demolish a mosque in North India and build a Hindu temple in its place.
India is in political turmoil. At least 100 people have died in religious violence which has erupted across the country since militant Hindus tore down a mosque in the northern town of Ayodhya yesterday.
There were riots all throughout the country, you know, for almost a year. Tens of thousands of people were killed.
One government minister said it was the worst crisis for secular India since Mahatma Gandhi's assassination in 1948.
Hindutva goes from being this fringe ideology and sort of comes to occupy center stage. That's when the BJP becomes the largest party in India's parliament.
Fundamental to the Hindu nationalist message is that Hindus are native to India. Historians have found that actually the origins of Hinduism came from the mixing of a thriving civilization in northwest India and the Aryans who came from outside India, something the Hindu nationalists deny.
Because they want the Hindus to be the sons of the soil, and therefore they are rewriting the Indian history in that light.
Christophe Jaffrelot is a senior research fellow at the French National Center for Scientific Research and visiting professor at the King's College India Institute.
The second thing that they are very much keen on is to depict the Islamization of India, the way Islam became one of the important religions of India, as a violent process.
Historians have pointed to the fact that Hindu rulers could be just as violent and that the RSS interpretations disregard important alliances between Hindus and Muslims.
And the last and probably most important thing that they want to change is related to the freedom movement.
An Indian newspaper recently reported that certain textbooks had erased all mention of India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. Nehru was a member of the Congress Party, a major rival of the ruling BJP.
They replace these heroes by their own personalities at the expense of the previous figures.
And obviously one of the best ways to do that is through education, is through changing textbooks.
Shoaib Daniel.
The RSS has a veto power on who's the education minister in India. That is something that the RSS considers key to its job, reaching kids when they're like 5 or 8 or 15. That's the best way to do it.
Most of the process of rewriting textbooks to suit the so-called saffron agenda, named for the color Hindus regard as sacred, comes at the state level, states where the BJP has won.
Critics of the Bhairav Singh Shekhawat government in Rajasthan say that the BJP is changing the very face of the curriculum by slipping in their saffron agenda.
First Rajasthan and Uttar Pradesh and now Mughal history has disappeared from Maharashtra state board textbooks.
Whatever we have learnt from British and Muslim emperors should be removed. It is time for our government to put the right heroes in the syllabus.
And the saffronization is not limited to grade schools. At the University of Delhi, the history, political science, sociology, and English department syllabi were revised last month.
So it goes through a four-step process.
Nandini Sundar is a professor at the Department of Sociology. This year, the syllabus creation and approval process was following the usual steps.
The teachers themselves who are involved in teaching the courses, the department committee of courses, the faculty level, and then the academic council.
until the National Democratic Teachers Front, a right-wing teachers union backed by the RSS, and a student group within the RSS family protested for changes.
English syllabus, they objected to a short story which showed the militant wing of the RSS in a bad light for their role in the 2002 Gujarat massacres in which large numbers of Muslims were killed. In the sociology syllabus, they wanted material on the joint family and ancient India to be included. In the history syllabus, they objected to various modules, including some things which were actually in a different period. It's really shutting down this university as a space for students, telling them that they cannot really exercise their critical faculties, that they must know only one side of a story, that anything that is open to debate or different interpretation is somehow taboo.
Step outside the classroom, and the rewriting of history is being enacted on brick and mortar.
All right, today we're asking what's in a name. Well, a lot of political...
In India, you have this campaign of renaming anything that has been named after a Muslim king.
Remember the century-old Mughal Sarai station on the busy Delhi-Howrah route? Well, it is getting a quick saffron makeover now. It will formally be renamed after RSS...
Even language in India, a country with more than 19,500 languages and dialects, is a contested ground.
A massive controversy erupted today over a proposal to possibly impose Hindi as a language in all schools.
They released the new education policy, which said that no matter your actual native language, you might be a Tamil speaker, you might be a Gujarati speaker, you might be a Bengali speaker, but you must learn Hindi.
The proposal didn't go through this time. Daniel, the reporter, says that in his speeches, even the Prime Minister himself has changed the narrative of Indian history.
When Mr. Modi made his first speech in Parliament 5 years back in 2014, it was almost a throwaway comment, you know, and you would have missed it if you sort of weren't cued in. He basically said India is now just getting over 1,200 years of slavery. Just this figure exemplifies a drastic shift in how India sees its own history. The standard narrative of Indian history is that India was under colonial rule for 200 years, which is under the British, right? The British basically first capture power in India in 1757, and then they leave in 1947, so that's 190 years, so 2 centuries of British colonialism. Usually, the kingdoms before that are not seen as colonial entities, but Modi wants us to see them as colonial entities. That's because a large number of medieval kingdoms in India were basically kingdoms ruled by Muslims. So in the Hindutva view of India, that is also colonial rule, much in the sense of how British rule is colonial rule. You know, this is a very fringe view of history, which sort of pushes that India has been a colonial power for 1,000 years.
I asked political scientist Christoph Jafferlow what he would say to those who claim that India's history for the last 70 years was rewritten by the people who want to cover up a true Hindu history.
It's a science history. It's a social science, but it's a science. So you have to get archives. You need to have evidence when you make some claim. We have archaeologists, historians, linguists who have been in a position to show for decades, here is the history that we can substantiate, for which there is evidence. They would respond to that by invoking not history, but legends.
Now there's yet another science and tech shocker from a BJP chief minister said that technology existed in this country during the Mahabharat time. That is, satellite communication existed during the Mahabharat time. If you don't believe me, listen for yourself.
Some of the impacts of the Hindu nationalists' efforts to rewrite the story of India are obvious and direct.
The Indian youth will probably not know the history of India it should if things continue at the same pace. You see young Indians ignorant of basic realities of India's history and living in fantasy to a large extent.
He points out that we've seen this story before in India's neighbor, Pakistan.
Pakistan has started the process of rewriting of history, of Islamization of the history of Pakistan, long time ago. And the young Pakistanis don't know what their history is about.
In other ways, the movement, combined with the effects of policies like the revocation of Article 370 in Kashmir, mean that the nature of Indian democracy is changing and that minorities are marginalized.
At the end of the day, the minorities cannot be recognized as full-fledged citizens because they don't have the same rights. They don't have the same access to jobs, to land, to their rights. So it's not only because of the writing of history, for sure, but it's a trend that is taking India on the ethnic democracy way.
All of this, of course, is happening against the backdrop of a marked rise in right-wing populism around the world. In Poland, a law was passed that makes it a civil offense to hold Poland responsible for the Holocaust. In Brazil, President Jair Bolsonaro denies that the Portuguese were responsible for the country's slave industry, saying that Brazil, quote, owes no debt to its black citizens. And in Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party has taken steps to remove the study of evolution from schools and has purged academics who favored democratic governance. And if some of this sounds at all familiar, it's because it is.
History may be getting an overhaul in Texas as the State Board of Education is set to vote on a new social studies curriculum that could affect classrooms across the country.
Out! Too much talk about Thomas Jefferson and the Enlightenment, which stressed reasoning and science over faith. In! More recognition of the contributions of religious leaders like Moses to American ideals.
This summer, Tejasvi Surya, a young, newly elected member of India's lower house of parliament and a strong supporter of Hindutva, spoke for the first time in front of the assembly of his colleagues. He was emotional as he described his personal journey.
The other most important thing that we witnessed in the last 5 years was that a culturally repressed country who could not wear its identity up its sleeve and proudly say that we belong to a civilization as great as ours, who, when a young Indian in school was made to cringe and feel apologetic that he belonged to a great Hindu faith, that has changed in the last 5 years, sir. And that, I think, is one of the irreversible changes which is beyond the confines of Indian politics.
It's hard not to hear echoes of Make India Great Again, a comeback from a conjured period of repression. This reimagining of India's story rejects the boisterous, multi-faith democracy that Nehru envisioned. Hindu, yes, but also Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Jain, atheist, Sikh, Jewish. The list is long. And as minority voices are squeezed out of the discussion, the fear is that this rewriting could be irreversible. For On the Media, this is Asta Chaturvedi.
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We just heard our producer, Asta Chaturvedi, describe the movement to challenge the founding myths of India. Now we move on to our own, with part one in our series about the myths of the American frontier, which we first aired in April.
James Monroe, writing about the U.S. in the 1820s, declared, "There is no object which as a people we can desire, which we do not possess, or which is not within our reach." That sentiment has driven centuries of history and that peculiar notion we call American exceptionalism. That seemingly limitless reach, that unappeasable desire, is said to have its roots in America's relationship with the frontier. Those of us alive today feel it mostly metaphorically. John F. Kennedy in 1960.
And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The frontier of the 1960s. The frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. The frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats.
Ronald Reagan in 1982.
As we hold to this new path, you and your forebears, as Malcolm said, tamed a wild frontier. And believe it or not, you did it without an area redevelopment program or urban renewal.
George W. Bush promising to, quote, extend the frontiers of freedom in the war on terror.
The story of America is the story of expanding liberty, an ever-widening circle, constantly growing to reach further and include more.
Endless possibility, but also endless consumption, endless military might. Presidents have promised boundless opportunity by pushing our boundaries ever outward, whatever the cost. But in his new book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America, historian Greg Grandin says that the movement outward has come to a screeching halt.
We're going
to
build the wall. We have no choice. We have no choice. Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
But first, Grandin takes us back to the underpinnings of the frontier ideology.
Ceaseless expansion. That there is no problem caused by expansion that can't be solved by more expansion.
In the next few weeks, we'll be unpacking the national narrative of expansion and exceptionalism. Next week, we'll expand our inquiry overseas, but this week, we've enlisted Greg Grandin as our transcontinental guide.
Thomas Jefferson's first political tract a couple of years before drafting the Declaration of Independence held out that the right to pick up and move, to escape tyranny, wasn't just a natural right, it was the condition of all other natural rights. And Jefferson laid out a moral history in which Saxon free men in what is now Germany, when feudalism began to take hold, picked up and moved over to the British Isles. And then when the layers of social life began to weigh heavy on Saxons and on the British Islands, then they just moved over to the Americas. His argument is that movement allows all other rights to take place.
And the founders acknowledged always that there would be tension between the haves and the have-nots. And James Madison's solution would be to extend the sphere, meaning territory.
The founders were fairly clear that a concentration of wealth would cause a problem to Republican virtue. One solution that was put forward by Jefferson was to redistribute property every generation so it didn't build up.
Take it from people?
He gave up that idea pretty quickly. And the solution that presented itself was fairly obvious, to extend the sphere, as Madison put it.
He believed that citizens spread over a wide territory would be less likely to join, quote, common interest or passion, or to discover their own strength and to act in unison with each other. This is pretty frank stuff.
Yeah, expansion was held out as the breaker of every paradox, the allayer of every fear.
So there was a metaphor for what expansion did, for its use as a remedy. It was called the safety valve to relieve the pressure. The pressure of what?
Well, one was a class pressure, the increasing number of wage laborers, immigrants that were coming into the country. How do you prevent a labor party from forming, for instance, that might challenge the sacrosanct right of private property? And the second problem the safety valve was thought to solve was the question of slavery.
You quote the editor of the Western Monthly Review, Timothy Flint. He proposed America buy Mexican territory because it would serve as the proper escape valve from the danger of too great an accumulation of blacks in the slave states. thinning the population by diffusing it over great surfaces. And when it comes to class, you have the Massachusetts Congressman Caleb Cushing in 1839, who called the West the great safety valve of our population.
One of the dangers that somebody like Cushing identified was that as the vote was extended to unpropertied white men, to working class, illiterate white men, the fear was that they would use that vote to vote in socialism, to vote in a labor party. So what to do? Their answer was to use the expansion West, the distribution of public land in the West, as a way of diffusing and dispersing concentrated social demands.
It seems that Cushing was also a bit of a libertarian because he hoped that the westward movement would also keep the government occupied.
Well, exactly, because that's the second problem, right? That the problem of concentrated wealth and the problem of social movements contesting that concentrated wealth is that you wind up having the growth of government trying to solve the problem, either becoming overly repressive in clamping down on the demands or overly generous in distributing property. And either of those solutions were anathema to somebody like Cushing. So what's the solution? You go west.
To explain how that frontier mentality set the U.S. on its ruggedly individualist trajectory, Grandin suggests we pause at 1848. Across Europe, it was a year of revolution. Workers were rising up in Paris, in Berlin, in Milan, where the La Scala Opera House was closed during a riot, delaying the opening of this work, Mercadante's opera, The Saracen Slave. The poor were waging war on the rich. Waging war upward.
It was like a wildfire, and basically it thrust the class question, the question of economics, into the political sphere. When you have the rise of industrial factories, when you have the spread of economic immiseration, from that moment, there emerges labor parties, an ethic of social democracy, the beginning of social rights, not just political rights, not just the right to property or the right to assemble, or the right to have free speech, but the right to health care, the right to education, rights that take a more activist government to form. In some ways, that's the inflection point, and that's what the United States does not develop. Its liberal tradition does not socialize. It does not move from embracing political rights and individual rights to expanding the palette to include the right to education, the right to health care. And 1848 is an interesting turning point. They don't have a revolution. What they have is a racist war against Mexico.
The end of the 19th century was a period of political theories. The dominant figure responsible for turning the frontier from a mappable place into an abstract idea is Frederick Jackson Turner at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
Up until that point, historians tended to argue what they called the germ theory of history. By that, they didn't actually mean bacteria, but they meant that everything that was good about American Anglo-Saxon culture came wholesale from Europe.
Germ meaning germinate.
The seed. That basically the Puritans created nothing. Their institutions were already perfected from Europe. Turner, born in Wisconsin, Midwestern, he turns that on its head. He says that what was good and unique and dynamic about America was born in America. It was born on the frontier. And he identified a number of particular traits that he felt were exceptional to the United States. One was individualism, crude intelligence that was practical, that was innovative, that was resilient. This becomes, in some ways, the foundation of an organic American-born Americanism.
And as you wrote, he glosses over the small matter of the series of Indian wars and the slavery question. The frontiersman is virtuous. There's no reference to the high price paid by some for the myth of boundless American freedom.
Absolutely. The frontier theory was implicitly and at times explicitly racist. But it's important to note that it didn't elevate racism as a motor of history.
The way the germ theory
The way did. That somebody like Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was also an historian. For him, war and the domination of Native Americans was the engine of history. It was from this violent, primal confrontation with base nature in the form either of Native Americans or of the natural world that creates civilization. There's none of that in Turner. Turner barely mentions war. Nothing as brutal that is on every page of Theodore Roosevelt.
It isn't slaughter
it isn't
that
slaughter.
Elevates one.
And this is important because America's about to launch itself into the Pacific, into the world. And if it has claims to universalism, that kind of out-and-out racism of the Saxon germ theory or of Theodore Roosevelt's war against nature is not a particularly useful way to think of how to organize the world. So Turner becomes an important way in which racism becomes sidelined. And the implication of his theory is that as the U.S. moves across the frontier, racism is left behind as a residue.
The frontier thesis, according to Turner, was a way to explain the formation of our national psyche through a particular sequence of events. First, settlers arrived in the wilderness. Then enterprising families follow after to work the land. Think Little House on the Prairie.
We crossed into Kansas 4 days ago. What are you looking for?
We had no future where we were. It was a hand-to-mouth existence at best. I want more than that for you and the children. 160 acres free and clear from the government. Chance to plant and harvest my own crops, to be owing to no man. I want that.
Eventually, those families assemble into communities, and then the communities coalesce to form civil society. And then, as Turner put it, as by magic, markets emerge.
Yeah, I need a plow and seed, enough for 100 acres.
Well, you've come to the right man. I sell only the best.
Finally, after everything is created and set in motion, the state arrives.
And the state's only legitimate function is to protect virtue, not to create virtue in the form of social rights.
But it was a lie. And he knew it.
It was a lie, and he knew it. In one of the articles that he was reading where he got a lot of his ideas, he has a little notation that says, government came before. Because the fact is that you don't have any of these things without government. You don't remove Native Americans off the land. Move them west. You don't create the infrastructure needed to create markets without a strong state. The West had always been the terrain of large-scale corporations or federal infrastructure projects that preceded the ideal of virtuous civil society mixed with nature.
The premise that the state doesn't show up till the end gave ballast to the idea that it had no responsibility to create social or economic rights. These things offered by the state would be perverse or unvirtuous?
This is a foundational premise of the ideal of a minimal state, of the ideal of individual rights being the only legitimate rights.
They want to replace individual rights with total government domination.
We know jobs are not created by government, and jobs are created by free markets.
Thomas Jefferson said, government that governs least governs best.
The denial of the state and government action and federal action in creating this world allows this fiction to take root and to flower.
I still don't get it. They're saying that it is literally unvirtuous to offer health care or education or welfare. Why?
Well, it would entail an intrusion in the realm of economics. And
meaning you'd have to tax people to pay for it.
You'd have to tax people to pay for it. You have to regulate the economy. What we call libertarianism in this country has deep roots.
Coming up, we'll hear more from Greg Grandin and the myth of the American frontier.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Now back to the second half of our conversation with historian Greg Grandin about the myth of the American frontier.
By the 1890s, the frontier had come to an end. The census officially declared there was no more open land in the West. Yet, the U.S. kept expanding to Puerto Rico, to Hawaii, to the Philippines. But more on that next week. Let's just observe that in discussing expansion post-1898, President Woodrow Wilson said, quote, We made new frontiers for ourselves beyond the seas.
Turner was a friend of Wilson and went along with pretty much everything Wilson did.
He was such a racist. He was just as racist as Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, yes. The frontier thesis moves from an historical theory to an ideology. It moves from an explanation of how and why something has happened to an argument for why something should happen. The frontier is understood not just as a line to stop at, but a line to cross over. There's not one president that doesn't use the frontier thesis to justify American power in the world.
But in some precincts, Turner's thesis was turned against itself. In 1912, Walter Weil, the future founding editor of the New Republic, wrote a piece describing the individualism championed by Turner as a curse. The Westward March of the Pioneer gave to Americans a psychological twist, which was to hinder the development of a socialized democracy. The open continent intoxicated the American. It gave him an enlarged view of self. It dwarfed the common spirit. It made the American mind a little sovereignty of its own, acknowledging no allegiances and but few obligations. It created an individualism, self-confident, short-sighted, lawless, doomed in the end to defeat itself, as the boundless opportunism which gave it birth became at last circumscribed.
Right? It's right there in that Walter Weil line that it inhibited a socialized democracy. The frontier is still being used to explain America, but now they're explaining all the things that are bad about America, all the things that are preventing America from developing a government that has the capacity to respond to mounting social problems. Weil used the word slum almost as much as Turner used the word frontier, right? There was a sense that political inequality, all the problems that come with industrialization, all the problems that come with mass migration, all of the problems that come with the rise of cities and concentrated populations, that the federal government was completely incapable of addressing those problems.
So, after the Great Depression was met with a bootless response from Herbert Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt endorsed the frontier theory as an explanation of the nation's past, and then, in his 1932 presidential campaign, declared it defunct.
So, in his famous Commonwealth Club speech in San Francisco during the presidential campaign, he spent some time laying out the Turner thesis and trying to explain the development of American capitalism and all of the good things that came from that. And then with just one sentence, he would just say, "But those days are gone."
In 1938, on the third anniversary of the signing of the Social Security Act, he brought it up again.
"And because it has become increasingly difficult for individuals to build their own security single-handed, government must now step in and help them lay the foundation stones. Just as government in the past has helped lay the foundation of business and industry."
Leveraging the power of the state to cure what ails its people? Now that was virgin territory.
"There is still today a frontier that remains unconquered, an America unreclaimed. This is the great and nationwide frontier of insecurity, of human want and human fear. This is the frontier, the America, that we have set ourselves to reclaim."
Roosevelt's brain trust wove Turner's thesis into all facets of the New Deal, including efforts to cope with the Dust Bowl brought on by unsustainable frontier farming.
A kind of strip mining of the soil that happened as a result of expansion, of just like moving on and moving on and moving on. And what these New Dealers did was they basically just affixed the word social to all these Turnerian categories. So instead of having democracy, now you had social democracy. Instead of having education, you had social education. Instead of having civilization, you had a social civilization.
Social justice through social action.
And he was also good at using the Turner thesis to explain the social relations of existence. He has one phrase, "this man-made world of ours." Again, these turns of phrases that capture a whole worldview, a new political ethic, a new political culture that was laying the groundwork for the closest the United States came to some kind of social democracy.
Isn't it weird how the argument over the frontier theory just keeps recurring and recurring. Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Here he is in his The Summer of Our Discontent speech in 1964.
We are a nation that worships the frontier tradition, and our heroes are those who champion justice through violent retaliation against injustice. It is not simple to adopt the credo that moral force has as much strength and virtue as a capacity to return a physical blow, or that to refrain from hitting back requires more will and bravery than the automatic reflexes of defense.
Yeah, and it speaks to the deeper level in which King presented his nonviolence, not just as a tactic, but really as a counter value to the whole of American history. King saw something deeply pathological in the myth of the West, in what he called rugged individualism for the many and the poor, but socialism for the rich in the form of subsidies and write-offs. And if somebody like Turner and other moral philosophers believed that individualism and the legitimacy of self-government had to do with your ability to regulate yourself, use your virtues to control your emotions, King transferred that more into the social realm, and he talked about African Americans who move through the social wilderness of racism and were able to not give in to anger and not give in to justifiable rage. And that was a higher claim to self-governance.
The Vietnam War, what Grandin calls the first frontier war we lost, was rife with frontier imagery. Soldiers gave names like Crazy Horse and Sam Houston to their air and ground operations and reportedly cut off the ears of dead Vietnamese. The historian Richard Drinnen noted that it was, quote, as if cowboys and Indians were the only game the American invaders knew. In 1970, the Mexican author Octavio Paz described the U.S. as a, quote, giant, which is walking faster and faster along a thinner and thinner line. With the Vietnam War, Grandin says, the U.S. hit its limit. It was around this time that the idea of border walls started to loom larger in the public's imagination, and conflict and vigilantism on the border became even more acute. In 1977, the Ku Klux Klan, led by David Duke, set up a border watch that was much covered by the press and supported by patrol agents. The association with that lost frontier war in Indochina went beyond the symbolic.
These sheet metal landing pads that were used to land helicopters and cargo planes in Vietnam, they were brought over and used as some of the first physical structures along the border.
And I was struck when you wrote that some of the fencing was repurposed from the Crystal City Japanese-American internment camp.
Right. So you see the wall taking shape from all of these different sediments and moments of U.S. racial history, the internments of Japanese in 1948, some of the first fencing when that internment camp in Crystal City was disassembled, the chain length and the posts were then used on the southern border.
If the country's lived past the end of its myth, the frontier myth, what replaces it?
The border wall. The idea that the world's resources are not limitless, not everybody could sit at the table, that the United States needs to batten down and needs to turn inward.
It's going to be only America first. America first.
The unique ability to constantly deflect outward, to flee forward, to divert social contradictions and class conflict and rate outward, to roll over the trauma from the last war into the next war, to use the promise of growth to organize domestic politics, to say whatever problems we have now will be solved in the future through more expansion. Now that that is no longer an option, the promise of unlimited growth has come crashing down in terms of the exhaustion of the economic model, the exhaustion of the military model, and climate change.
Tell me again why you wrote this book.
I was trying to figure out a way to get beyond what had seemed to be a simplistic opposition in talking about Trump. Trump was either presented as completely unprecedented, an interruption in the United States' long history of proceduralism and pluralism and multilateralism and openness, or if one was more critical of the United States, Trump was presented as the culmination of a brutality that was in there from the beginning and settled a colonial expansion. You know, I think that opposition fails to account for the contingencies of more immediate history. What happened with Iraq? What happened with changes in the political economy? What happens with climate change and the way that that has scrambled politics and the way politics could be organized? I was trying to present a way to think about Trump historically that didn't fall into one or the other. He's wholly new, or he's just the fulfillment of settler colonialism.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke, for having me.
Greg Grandin is a professor of history at New York University and author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America.
Tune in next week for part two in our series, where we discuss how to hide an empire. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.